got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, how you doing on this beautiful morning?
Hey, how's it going, eh?
Oh yeah, you betcha.
I wanted to do the Bob and Doug McKenzie intro for the longest time. I'm feeling it.
If you can, keep that accent up for the entire episode.
Today we're going to do it in Canadian for our friends.
Oh, yeah. We'll tell you about the anti-vaccine folks, eh?
Oh, jeepers.
Anyways, well, we've got three pretty cool stories to talk about today, so let's dive right in as Kevin collects himself.
I'm going through my scrolling through my Canadian terminology in my head, and I'm thinking how funny that could be. But let's not do it.
We'll do on the next episode. We'll do like an extra segment, so if it sucks, we can just delete it, and if not, we'll just use it.
Good job, hoser.
All right. Well, with that out of the way, according to several new studies, arguing with anti-science activists on social media actually changes people's minds, contrary to what you may have heard from some science communication experts. Organic advocacy groups have sued the USDA to block federal GMO labeling guidelines. And finally, agroecology, which is another fancy term for organic farming, keeps African farmers trapped in poverty, according to a new meta-analysis that we're going to look at. So the question is, why does the UN and why do so many environmental groups keep promoting these farming techniques if they don't work? But let's dive into this first story, Kevin, about science communication. Sort of counterintuitive, as I read it, is what I thought.
Well, it is in a way, but at the same time, it has a great punchline. And maybe I'll give that first, is that if you are interested in science, if you feel that you have command of some of these topics, there's genetic engineering, you know, vaccination, climate, COVID, get involved in the conversation online. And this is an article called How to Constructively Engage on Social Media with Those Who Post Anti-GMO and Anti-Vax Conspiracies. And it's by Mary Mangan. And Mary, you know online as Mem Somerville. And Mary has been a very effective voice in refuting BS over the years, and I've really appreciated her efforts, and she has some very strong feelings about especially the more academic side of this, who will say to people participating in social media, you're doing it wrong. And I think that I agree with her that it takes all types. It takes diplomats and brawlers and and the spectrum in between to be able to be persuasive and cohesive. The trick is just getting in there and talking to people. So that's really where this starts.
One of the most important points she makes, I think, is that the activist groups are really in it to win it. They will break rules. They will lie about people. They will lie about the evidence, as we've documented pretty extensively on the show. And so I think the key from the article is that you have to fight back aggressively. You don't have to be dishonest or deceptive, but you have to be willing to push the boundaries sometimes of what may make you comfortable or how you typically would approach a discussion like this. What are your thoughts? I mean, this is what you do for a living. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that what her thesis really is you have to do what you do best. And if that's being aggressive and, you know, calling names and whatever, you know, I mean, why most of us don't like to do that because we find the high road more effective. There are other people who achieve a change by those more aggressive techniques. And some of the academic science on this says that it doesn't really matter what the message is in terms of how it's being delivered. So in other words, whether you punch somebody back or hug them back, doesn't matter. To the observer, it is somebody putting resistance to a bad piece of information. And that's what this is all about. It's about the internet being a spectator sport. And she had a couple of researchers here who she cites who were providing information at Miss InfoCon last year, which was at the National Academies of Science. I wish I would have went to that. But their whole their thesis, one of their things that they came up with was that that you can participate in social media in uncivil ways, yet it still makes a good impact. And that was kind of a surprise to me because so many of the academic folks, and you know myself included, really pound the table aggressively about not being aggressive and pounding the table. We ironically make the point that that you know high road and gentle wins, and I do believe that for me that's what works. But everybody's welcome, and everybody needs to be involved, no matter how you choose to do it.
Right, and to follow up on that, I think what's really interesting is that people care about their social standing and they care what other people think about them. And so what this research seems to suggest to me is that you can utilize that to change people's minds in ways that that really matter. And so the example she gives is, you know, if you're in a conversation on Facebook about one of these issues, say vaccines, and you correct misinformation, it's the guy watching you interact with that person who is probably going to be most affected, even if the initial poster isn't affected. And I don't think I've ever shared this story, at least on this podcast, but I grew up in a very conservative church. And of course, evolution was just the worst possible thing in the entire world. And I really embraced that in my teenage years. And it wasn't until I got an internship in science journalism where I started to realize I didn't know anything. You know what I mean? I hadn't really studied the issue in any serious way. I didn't know what I was talking about. But I only came to that realization because part of the work that we were doing was fielding questions, or not me personally, but you know, the organization was fielding questions about evolution and reporting on the debate that was going on about teaching creationism in schools. And so just observing that in real time forced me to go, wait a minute, you know, I'm really overstepping my bounds here. And if I was forced to defend this to someone who knows what they're talking about, I'd look stupid. And so it just made me reevaluate. So all that to say, I think my experience matches up with what these researchers found.
Well, one of the big points is that people want to be correct, but they don't want to be corrected. Okay, so then it's a big difference. You don't want to be on the receiving end of somebody telling you you're wrong. Yet if you observe somebody correcting someone else, that is very powerful, because and especially when it's multiple people who have different edges of the same argument that build on each other, that does have the possibility to create change. And the authors refer to this as observational correction. And the authors were Bodhi and Vraga. They did a number of tests in social media to examine this hypothesis. And some of the things they did were pollute the social media with bad information, like the origin of Zika virus, you know, that kind of thing. And you would find that people would jump in to make those corrections and would change the minds of people who were being surveyed as to whether or not they believe the information and how they changed their mind. So the research is starting to show that just participation does make a difference. So punchline, get out there and talk to people.
Yeah, without a doubt. So maybe that's just the best takeaway, is everyone's going to do it differently. And I think the line she uses is something like, you do you your way. And that's how we're going to turn the tide in these conversations.
Yeah, that's Mary 100%. And you know, I really appreciate that she took the time to write this, because it's spot on. And it really does give an important overlay to the growing field of science communication in social media space. So very nice job.
So moving on then to another lawsuit. We talk about lawsuits a lot, it seems, but we have here, it's the Center for Food Safety and a handful of other groups suing the U.S. Department of Agriculture to block the new bioengineered food labeling standards that go into effect in 2022, I believe. So tell us about this story.
Oh, geez. Oh, cry. Got to get some poutine after this one. No, this one drives me nuts for a lot of reasons. So what's happening is that, let's go back to what the National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard is. So after years of failed state ballot initiatives, or some almost barely passing and one passing, to get GMO labels on food. So they wanted the skull and crossbones GMO word right on the front, you know, taking up half the front of the label. They want very conspicuous. And the problem with this was, is that when you had a patchwork of laws in different states, how does somebody buy something from Vermont if they're in Wisconsin and you want Vermont syrup or whatever? And how do you have your state's label rules enforced? And the other problem obviously was, different states had different standards. And so Vermont would not label dairy that had, or cheese that used a genetically engineered enzyme, because, you know, that's their product. And but they wanted sugar and other stuff from other places labeled. So it was a lot of contradiction, and it was a horrible time, and I remember it well, and I hated every minute of it. So the compromise, as compromise usually goes, is where everybody leaves the table unhappy, was this idea of this National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard. And what it is, it's a rule that says anything that contains detectable genetic material from a genetically engineered crop has to be labeled if it's not able to be done through conventional breeding or found in nature. So it basically says genetically engineered corn, soy, sugar beets, and canola. That, you know, that's what it is. And if you can find the DNA. And so stuff would be tested, and if you had detected DNA, you would be labeled. The problem is that, well, we can get to that in a second. The lawsuit, it's against Sonny Perdue and the USDA, so bummer. And by the National Grocers, Citizens for GMO labeled GMOs, and of course the Center for Food Safety, who is the legal powerhouse behind this, that has the money and the legal expertise to be able to forward these kinds of lawsuits.
So there's so much to talk about here, but one thing I want to stress is that I think these groups are right, but for the wrong reasons. The law really doesn't make sense. And I want to give you a quote here. This is from Drew Kirshen and Henry Miller. And Drew is a legal scholar. And of course, Henry Miller is a former FDA a biotech regulator. But one thing they point out, and they've written multiple articles on this, but because, as you said, if you can't detect the DNA in the product, then you're not required to label the product, but you're allowed to. And so you could have, for example, two bottles of corn oil, and one could be labeled GMO and the other could be not labeled at all, even though they might be made from corn that was grown in the same field, or you know what I mean? So that's right. That's just so goofy to me. If the idea is to inform people, then, you know, you shouldn't do anything like that. And in my mind, what that illustrates is you shouldn't label stuff for no reason. You label it because there's a potential health hazard, or because you're trying to inform people about the nutritional details. And that's really where it should stop.
Oh, you're spot on. And just for the listener who maybe isn't familiar with the story and the process, is that what they're trying to do, Center for Food Safety and these folks, is get a label on the process, not the product. Okay. And so this is really important, because the product is what the consumer cares about. Is it safe? Is there something in there I need to worry about? The things like corn oil or soybean oil or beet sugar, canola oil, these are huge products that come from genetically engineered plants. But the products themselves are not genetically engineered. The products are just sugar and oil. And when you purify those away from the rest of the plant, there's no DNA there. There's no material coming along. Yet, and so when you, like your example, the two bottles of canola oil or corn oil, they're identical. They're chemically identical. An organic one, a non-GMO one, and a GMO one are chemically identical and you can't tell them apart. So I would say, why do you need a label if you can't tell them apart, you know, in terms of what they are quantitatively, what they are in terms of their safety and nutrition? And so this has never been really clear for a lot of people. Like, why would you have to tell them apart? And that tells what shows what this really is. This is not worrying about the consumer. It's not worrying about food safety. It's about targeting biotechnology and making sure that farmers don't have access to that technology.
Yeah, and just to be clear, they've been very explicit about that. I know Organic Consumers Association has said that, and so has Center for Food Safety on different occasions. They've said very clearly that you stigmatize the products by labeling them, because as we were just talking about, a label implies there's something you need to be aware of, and then you can use that to demonize products that you want to say are harmful or you don't know if they're safe. And so that really is the starting point of this whole push to ban these products. And that's why they led with the labeling campaigns. But one thing this lawsuit is that CFS claims to speak for consumers, and they say that, you know, people wouldn't expect you to use a word like bioengineered. And so you are denying consumers information that they want. But in reality, most of these state level labeling initiatives failed. So when you went to the ballot box or when you put something on the ballot, people voted and they said, we don't really care about this. I think Vermont was the only one that passed one. I could be wrong about that, but I know the bulk of them failed.
That's right. Yeah, it was only Vermont that passed. And if you go back to that time, it was really awful because the anti-biotech folks were putting commercials on TV that were flat out lies. And then the big ag companies were putting commercials on TV that were flat out lies. And so you just had deception countered by deception and consumers in the middle that didn't know what to believe. So they tended to vote for their pocketbook, which was, you know, the biggest threat from the biotech companies was, well, this is going to raise your prices on food and your family will starve. And, you know, and so that was, that's probably why these barely didn't pass. But the bottom line is that these are completely useless laws. And all of this money and all of this time and all of this discussion, this is about anti-GE or anti-biotech folks wanting to stop companies from selling biotech seeds or stop farmers from growing them. That's what this is all about. And so here we are in the middle of a pandemic with a million other things that we should be challenging and putting our energy into. And we're busy we're seeing tons of money spent suing the USDA over a package decoration. I mean, it doesn't compute.
Right. And just to, by the way, this isn't cost-free. So to put this label on and to write the regulations and then have the USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service operate this program, it's going to cost, I believe it's $3 billion in the first year that it's going to be implemented. And then it's going to be something like $350 million annually in perpetuity. Yeah. So this is incredibly expensive. So if you're listening, you're paying for this label, which is conveying no useful information.
In perpetuity and everywhere else.
Yeah.
It's a small town in Maine. It's
all that to say, it's ridiculously expensive. And Kirshen and Miller, when this was being debated, their suggestion was the USDA could step in, Congress could step in and just tell the states, you're not allowed to put any GMO label on your products because we have three regulatory agencies that are responsible for this in different capacities. And that's the end of the debate. So instead of passing this law, they could have just shut it down. And I don't know if legally that's an option now. So if this lawsuit succeeds and the USDA has to rewrite these regulations, I don't know if Congress could just say, okay, enough is enough. You know, we're gonna label this if federal regulators say there's a reason to label it. And the FDA pointed out like 30 years ago that there's no reason to label these as an entire class of products for the reasons we've been discussing. So maybe that turns out that way. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get out my calendar here. I'm going to thumb my way to 2026, and I'm going to put a big X on today's date. And I bet when we get to that point, none of this is relevant. And with gene editing happening the way it is, with so many other things happening in the world, and anti-biotech movement that is kind of losing steam, that by the time this is ready to be implemented in 2022, I can't imagine anybody will even care, let alone years down the road from that. So in a way, lawsuits being what they are and all of the continuances and, you know, glacial process of the courts, this may not even ever be an issue, that they'll take this thing in and ask for revision, but nobody will really care. And maybe eventually these folks will move on to other things. Folks like Kimbrell have been fighting this for 25 years, and it's like, get a life, you know? There's other things in, that we can do to help people rather than just try to go after big ag companies.
Right. Maybe take up gardening or golf or stamp collection.
Macrame, you know, philatelism, right? Isn't that what it is? Stamp collecting.
Oh, it has its own fancy name. I didn't know that. Yeah, I just called it stamp collecting.
It sounds dirty. I think it's philatelism. I think that's right. I don't know.
Anyways, well, until he takes up those hobbies, let's talk about a related story, which is the fact that organic farming keeps people poor. So what's going on here, Kevin?
Yeah, this is another really sad story where good intentions backfire. And it really focuses on, well, first of all, it's written by Mark Linus, and people know Mark. He's a prolific author. He also is affiliated with the Cornell Alliance for Science, which is where this article originated. And it talks about the concept of agroecology, which we've discussed here, which is kind of this philosophy of growing crops in an ecosystem. So rather than it being a farm of disparate crops, which are grown in their own places, trying to mesh agriculture with the surrounding ecology, the pests and pathogens and the critters that are there, and with the idea of getting beneficials on site to be able to have more productive farming. And it's a cool idea. You know, I mean, I'm down with that if it worked. And more research is certainly ongoing, but the problem is that in the poorest areas of the world, in areas of sub-Saharan Africa, the UN and World Health Organization, other organizations, other charities, they tie their aid to it being used in agroecology. So if you don't do it our way, you don't get the money. And you've got farmers that maybe know of more effective ways to do things using modern tools, using modern genetics, using irrigation. Unfortunately, this does not fit into the agroecology construct.
And one point he makes that I think everyone should remember, and you sort of alluded to it just now, but there's nothing wrong with this type of farming. And in fact, you know, a practice like no-till, for example, is really good for the soil health. But they explicitly reject any kind of biotech seed, any kind of modern fertilizer or pesticide, even if they are a step forward in terms of sustainable farming. And so that's what people need to remember. You know, it's the rejection of technology. It's not that you care about the environment or that you want to adapt your practices to where you're growing food. It's just this sort of ideological commitment. You know, you're just banging your head against the wall because you're dedicated to this idea, regardless of what the facts actually tell you.
That's exactly right. And you know, there's been some academic work on this, and there's been papers that have been published that really show that it's no better than traditional farming. And as Linus points out, that is not saying that it is as good as traditional farm or as conventional farming. He says it's as bad as, you know, equally bad, you know, that you have something that still is not, that still has limitations and still has drawbacks when you weigh it against social needs and food needs, food security. And so what one of the main points that comes up in this is that in my readings is the labor dependence in maintaining an agroecological system. And this typically in the developing world falls on the majority of the burden falls on women. And they're the ones who do the hand weeding. They're the ones who do a lot of the, you know, hand plowing and that kind of work, you know, the cultivation. And it keeps young girls out of school. You know, there's a lot of social edges to this that lead to the gender equality, inequalities that we see in certain places. And that's another unfortunate edge of this.
Yeah, it's really terrible. And I remember I read this story and then I had to go outside a little bit later in the day and start digging up crabgrass that is trying to invade my backyard. And it's like 105 outside and I'm out there with this little shovel and I'm just trying to dig these things out so they leave my grass alone because I'm such a yuppie. But I thought for a second, I'm like, you know, if I had to do this for food, I would be so pissed. You know, it's just really cruel that we have the tools to help people feed themselves and start to build a life and build their societies. And we're denying them that for these, I'm not sure, for these ideological reasons or, you know, people just aren't paying attention. I don't know what the motivations are in the case of the people that are backing this. But it's really unfortunate. It saddens me, really.
Well, it is sad, especially because you can't take something like sub-Saharan Africa, a place like sub-Saharan Africa, and paint it with a broad brush that says, here is something that, you know, that will work for you, because it's just not true. That whenever you're talking about any agricultural approach, whether it's conventional, agroecological, whatever, it's going to vary depending upon the crop, on your availability of water, on the geographical location, on your access to inputs. You know, what do you, a lot of these places are remote and don't have access to certain types of seed or fertilizer or insect control or things that would be used in an agroecological integrated pest management strategy. So you can't just paint sub-Saharan Africa with a broad brush and then hold the carrot out there and say, if you want it, you got to do it our way. And it's just unfair. It's unproductive and ultimately hinders food security when we should be doing everything we can to enhance it.
Right. And one thing that popped up to me as I was reading the story is that I suspect that the advocates of agroecology, they're really good at marketing their ideas. And they rely on anecdotal data. So maybe they will make a video about a single farmer and in many cases it might be a woman and they'll say, look at the success she's had with this, you know, and you know, this is all about working together and feeding the world in a sustainable way. And so I think that really touches the people who they're targeting with that kind of marketing. So give me your thoughts on that, going back to the science communication angle.
Well, but they did that in food evolution too. With genetically engineered bananas, right? I mean, it's a very important tactic from the side of science communication because it incorporates the pathos. It brings in emotion and it shows a connection to a person. You know, it brings in that the empathy for that person and their situation, especially the poor and the food insecure. And when you see somebody able to use a given modality to rise out of that or to meet that challenge, it gives us a warm and fuzzy that is extremely effective and extremely persuasive. The problem is, as you point out, that this is one example. And we also don't know the limits of the other variables that went into that outcome. And so we have to be extremely careful. And I think the best take-home message is, let's not tie the technological hands of the poorest people in the food insecure. Allow them to have all technologies on the table, teach agroecology through extension, teach genetic engineering and use of biotech seeds, teach use of the best chemistries that are safe and sustainable, and let them make up their own minds. And you know, and that's all that's fair, because that's what we do here.
Absolutely. Don't tie your hands if you're trying to build something. It's kind of a rough analogy, but you get what I'm saying.
I get it. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
So tell us about Talking Biotech. This week, Kevin.
Some really interesting ones lately. The most recent one that was posted is on prions, which are infectious protein particles that are transmissible. So it's not a virus, not a bacterium, not a fungus, but it can kill you with a really bad brain disease. So prions are fantastic, really interesting story. And then the other one that's coming up next weekend is about the mRNA vaccines for COVID that are being produced by a company called Moderna. And I spoke with Catherine Elton, who is a senior editor at Boston Magazine, who talks about her interviews and her time covering the Moderna story and just a turn of events that have accelerated the production of new vaccines at a record-breaking pace. Really fascinating interview.
Sounds like it. I'm going to go listen to it. Everyone else should too. And that's going to do it for today. Go check us out, geneticliteracyproject.org. And we're on Twitter if you want to say thank you or fight with us, whatever the case may be, at Kevin Folta, at Cam J. English. And we will see you guys next time.